Welcome to the Dialogue by Wirepoints, connecting the dots between our economy, government, and people. And now your hosts, Ted Dabrowski and Mark Glennon.
Hello, this is Ted Dabrowski from Wirepoints. Welcome to the Dialogue, Wirepoints podcast, and I'm joined by Mark Glennon, my partner. And today, the subject of our podcast is about school choice. Something that Mark and I are passionate about, and we wanted to do this topic, so here we are, and we're happy to have a great guest. But before I introduce him, we know that one of the biggest kitchen table issues for most families, arguably, is their kids' education. And if you look at the world we've lived in, especially during COVID, we've seen all kinds of things pop about schools that are infuriating a lot of parents or certainly creating a lot of debate. CRT, you know, critical race theory is one of them, sexually explicit books, COVID mandates, a declining curriculum, forced remote learning, all those things have captured our schools. And, we've seen that play out like in Virginia recently in the elections there. So, you know, in Illinois in specific, we've had this CTU walkout, the Chicago Teachers Union, that walked out for 4 days just last week. We saw one of the best high schools in the country cancel exams, New Trier, cancel their exams because of the COVID problems just now. We saw 60 school districts put on probation for opposing the mask mandate last year. Recently, we saw Glenbrook High School threatening to cancel sports for kids who won't meet the COVID mandates. So the fight is on. The mama bears are waking up. Parents' rights is the big thing. And we've got an election in 2022. So this is going to be, I think, a hot issue along with the crime we've seen in Chicago. So I think that's the big question. Is Illinois ready and ripe for more school choice? As I've mentioned in a previous podcast, I've seen a lot of mama bears in the last few weeks. They're fired up. I've never seen that many who are eloquent about the issues, want to get into the issues. And so with that, let me introduce Robert Enlow. I've known Robert for quite a few years in my work that I've done in school choice. And Robert's the president and CEO of EdChoice, one of the nation's most respected advocates for school choice. And I know Robert's been working in lots of states to push parental freedom. They do research, they train, they do seminars, they back community leaders. And so they're great. And he's got something even more cool is that he got to work with the Freedmans and the Freedman Foundation for Educational Choice back when it was founded in 1996. And later he was the CEO of the foundation. So Robert's got a great background. He's the guy that can actually speak about what actually happens to school choice across the country. So let me just start with the first obvious question before we get into, you know, I want to hear a little bit about what inspired you to get into school choice, what it was like working with Milton Friedman. But first, lay out for people who don't understand, you know, what exactly is school choice? What does it look like? What are some of the nuts and bolts that as people hear you discuss it later on in the conversation, they've got a good base for what school choice is?
Well, so that's a great question. Thanks for having me, Ted. And thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate you guys having me on this podcast. Let's talk about school choice, or what we really say is educational choice, right? Because it's not just about the ability to choose a school. It's about the ability to choose the best educational environment for your child, whether that's a mix of schools or a mix of online and a home or a mix of however you want to do it. Like ostensibly the way we run every other part of our life. But when you want to talk about school choice and educational choice, there's something that people need to know. Every parent has it, and they already use it. There are five ways that you can access education in America, right? One of them is you move to a school district you think is the best for your kid. That's school choice. You're choosing to move in many ways because your kid. You can pay for it. You can get a private education by paying for it. You can get in a lottery and get lucky and get to a charter school. You can get a voucher or scholarship and get as a low-income family often and get access to a private school, or you could homeschool, right? Or the lastly thing you could do is you could lie about your address, right? And so the reality is there's a certain, everyone is already doing as a parent is accessing some form of school choice. What we talk about when we talk about educational choice and opportunity is this. We believe that the public funding of education through taxpayers, right, should be empowering taxpayers to choose and parents to choose the best educational options for their children, not schools. So we don't think public school districts, right, should be the ones to determine where kids go. We think parents should do that and that moving should not be the reason for them to do that. So what we really talk about when we talk about school choice is the ability of a parent to control all of the educational dollars to go to all of the educational opportunities available for their children, whether those are public, private, charter, online, or at home. So really, this is about a parent's ability to control the money and the location, right? Think about it this way. Remember when you had to go to Tower Records to get a record, right? Then you had Napster, and you changed how you accessed music. Then you had Apple, and you could change where and how. As you change the delivery of education, you change the ability of families power to control where you get an education, how you get education, and when you get an education. This is what school choice is about, giving parents the money for them to control their children's education. It's something we all access already.
So Robert, clarification, because I know this always comes up. I've always used the word vouchers, and then I learned about education savings accounts. Others want to call them opportunity scholarships. There's all these different names.
Correct.
You want to just give a quick background on the different forms of choice so that people have a concept there too.
Sure. So again, let me back up to the top. You can call them pink elephants. It's about the controlling of the money, right? But the way we've done it in the past, right, has been threefold, right? One, through the use of vouchers. Now, vouchers are publicly funded grants to families who go to private schools, right? That's a voucher. An education savings account is publicly funded grants that go into an account that parents can use to customize, whether it's going to a private school part-time, a charter school part-time, or having a tutor at home, or having an online version. It's customizable education, which is why it's growing so fast. In the last year, that's been the type of program that has grown more than any other type of program. And then there's this thing called scholarship tax credits, right? Scholarship tax credits are donors who want to give money to a nonprofit, get a tax credit from it from the state, and the nonprofit then gives out scholarships to children to go to private schools, right? So it's a win-win for donors and parents. And so those are the three basic types of private school choice. I always look at it this way. We publicly fund our government-run schools. We publicly fund our independent-run charter schools. Why would we not publicly fund our parents to go wherever they want? Right. And that is the goal of the private school choice movement.
Well, it's equality of choice. Yeah, the civil rights issue of our time is, as many have said, and I certainly agree with that. Robert, one of the things, this is Mark Glennon here. One of the things that strikes me about this topic is how popular it is. And I don't have the poll numbers at my fingertips, but I've seen a number of them, and they go up to 80% approval rates across the country, across ethnic groups, across party lines. Do I have that right? And what's your sense of that? You work around the country on this.
So it's super interesting. Yes. And particularly in the last 2 years, because of COVID, because of everything, the numbers have been higher than they've ever been. So the minimum for education savings account poll numbers that we do, 70% support, even among Democrats, right? The support from the public, from Democrats, particularly people of color, particularly women who are in urban areas, very, very high. The lowest support, ironically, tends to be educated white women who live in suburbs, which is a whole nother conversation.
Yes, it is. We'll be careful there. Okay.
But that's the reality. I mean, but the fact is, Mark, the poll numbers are very clear. The public and every demographic of the public supports this.
Including inner cities, minorities, they understand this topic, you think?
Significantly higher, right? And remember this, because most inner city families have a lot more options than most families in suburban or rural areas, right? So there's more charter schools in big urban areas. There's more private schools in big urban areas. So they understand and support the idea a lot more.
So if it's that high across the party lines, what is the politics that's blocking us? We might as well go right there because, right, if you have the minorities, you would think immediately, well, then Chicago should have. Now, of course, Chicago does have a lot of charter schools, and that's we'll talk about charters in a bit. But you would think that the ability to have a choice in vouchers or some kind of education savings account would be, in theory, then a viable opportunity in a place like Chicago.
So what you're really talking about with choice, I think it's twofold. We get to the unions, right? The fact is a monopoly blocks everything. And that's what we have. Let's take a look at from a libertarian / conservative type perspective. We want choice and competition in education because a monopoly doesn't provide a good product to make sure kids get educated. From a left side leaning idea, we think a monopoly creates social injustice. In fact, we know it creates social injustice, right? And so what you're finding about this idea, though, is not just about unions. It's about those who control the system at all levels. the principals, the principal association, the school boards association, the school districts. Remember, in America, this is the first time in the last 10 years where we have more non-teachers in education than teachers, right?
That's phenomenal.
It's a terrible thing, right? But I will tell you this. We have a cultural discussion ahead of us around this. Parents exercising choice is not something many parents have done. They've done it by buying a house, right? So I don't know about you, but my first choice was by buying a house. And we take that as for granted. And when we're telling parents it's not just buying a house anymore, you actually got to go figure it all out. It's a cultural change, and we need to do a lot more informing of parents about what do they want, how do they want it. We've got to do a much better job of providing information to parents. So that's part of the obstacles, Ted. Like, how are parents informed? What are they informed about? What choices do they have? Where are those choices? And if you're only giving them choices of, let's say, public, private, and charter, are we really giving them all the options that they could have, right? I think the things that are blocking school choice are a monopoly. And remember, you guys know this. When did the school districts, was it 1934 Banking Act that Roosevelt did? Remember that? I think it was 32 or 34, where, sorry, this is so boring and esoteric, but it's important because the federal government said we need to get loans for houses. And so they went and drew blue lines around places, green lines, and red lines. And they said, you can give a lot of loans to the green blue lines and a lot of loans to the green lines. Don't give any loans in the red lines. If you look at our school districts in most urban areas, it's almost the exact same district boundaries as the red lines of the 1930s. You have a monopoly that is basically destroying people's lives. And we know that, right? And then we got to inform parents. It's like both and. We got a monopoly that doesn't want you to choose. And then we got to spend a lot more time informing parents of their choices.
Go ahead, Mark.
Go ahead. I was just going to say that's fascinating. You're here in Chicago, we continue to hear lots about redlining continuing. And if that, in fact, is contiguous with where the bad schools are, it's something that minorities need to be aware of that have to live in those areas. Yeah. Ted, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things I learned whenever ESAs, educational savings accounts, came out, I remember getting so excited. So here you have a parent or family, they now have an account that's funded, and they can take that money and design it, like you said, get a tutor for this part where my son is really weak, maybe use the public school for this part, and maybe, whatever it is, you can design it whatever way you want. And that's just so innovative and so refreshing. And I think it would just be exciting. Now, so with that, tell me, for people in Illinois, so what is who's got the best model of school choice out there? What state does it really well? Maybe said another way is, what is the most innovative state, and which states are maybe the least innovative?
Well, that's really good. So there's a lot of states with school choice right now, some school choice programs, right? So almost all states have charter schools, and now about 35 states have private school choice. There are two questions you asked there. Which one's doing it really well and which ones are doing it very innovative, right? The states that have tons of choice that are doing a great job, Arizona, Indiana, Florida, and Ohio. There are just so many options. A state like Indiana, you could go across every public school district. It's the largest choice program in the world. You don't have to actually be assigned anymore. 70,000 families out of 100,000 or 1 million already use that program. We have a voucher program that will be about 60,000 this year. And we have charter schools that have about the same amount. So now you're looking at a market share in Indiana of about 20 to 30% of families choosing. And you're really beginning to change the dialogue of options.
Hey, Robert, could you stay in Indiana for a minute? That's, you're in our neighboring state. And you live in Indianapolis, I believe, right? Or somewhere.
Yes. Yep.
So, we talk a lot about, we lose a lot of people to Indiana. Well, Illinois loses a lot of people to a lot of states, but Indiana is one of the biggest recipients of those.
So we're your third, the third highest people come from Chicago to Indiana.
Correct. So I know one of those things. I mean, people, I don't think, go there for school choice initially. They go there for the lower taxes, for the opportunity. But one of the huge benefits they get is school choice. So make sure that our listeners here understand the power of what Indiana did, because it's not that old, right? It's only been a few years that it's been in place, and it's really expanded. You keep growing it, and it seems to be very successful. So please just elaborate more.
Oh, no problem. In Indiana, our state has passed a law that will now allow, as of last year, anyone earning 300% of free and reduced price lunch to get a scholarship worth up to 90% of what the state would spend on their family. So what that means in real life is a family of six who earns $190,000 can get up to $7,000 per kid to go to private schools.
I mean, No questions asked.
Is if the school accepts them, they get a voucher. It's that simple. And so you basically made it to the point now where 80% of the families in Indiana are eligible to get a scholarship. And now 100% can go to any public school they want, and 100% could go to any charter school. So we're creating this system of educational options, which is amazing in this state. And the dollars follow the kids to the schools of their choice. Remember, that's how dollars work already in public schools. I mean, I think if people need to really be clear on this, when a child goes to a public school, the public school gets three sources of funds, right? Federal, state, and local money, typically. When that child leaves that public school to go to another public school, what happens to that money? That money follows that kid to that school. They get the same amount. The same thing will happen with a charter school. And what we're trying to do now is say the same thing should happen to a non-public school. The dollar should follow kids across the board. And that's what's happening in a great state like Indiana. And that's why families are flocking here, right? People know that there's a lot of options in our state.
And Robert, how about intrastate migration? Big cities, of course, are having huge problems retaining population for a lot of reasons, crime, remote working, fiscal problems. It's been our belief that a major draw for Chicago, if they could get it done, would be schools, because people that want to educate their kids properly obviously are not coming. I mean, if you don't have as severe problems in Indianapolis, but are there, have you seen any effects on intrastate migration, or do you think we're on the right track with that?
I will tell you that our urban areas have become more populated than ever before with families, right? So what's happening in Indiana is our families are moving back into urban areas because they can actually go to different schools. And so we're seeing migration. Plus, what's really interesting is, you know this because you live in Illinois and you're Midwestern. So there are a lot of cities that are what not called big cities, but sort of like, you know, 100, 150,000, 200,000 towns, like in our state, Kokomo and Muncie. These are old steel towns, old sort of manufacturing towns that have gone by the wayside. These districts that live around them are just sucking people out of them. And those school districts are having to respond really quickly. And as a result, they're doing many more innovative things. And so you're beginning to see this sort of in-migration from different parts of the state to the urban areas again.
So does competition work there? You know, competition is always a bad word when we talk about it in school choice and schools. People don't like that word. Mark and I would argue that if Chicago Public Schools ever had, well, they have competition. People are just leaving the city or leaving the state. But if they felt like there were schools nearby that were stealing all their students, they might have to change their attitude, their customer service. How is that working out? Is it helping the public schools in Indiana improve, as is often argued it would happen?
So the data in Indiana, early data that we got from the voucher program, is that elementary schools are getting, public elementary schools in areas where there's high competition are getting better faster a little bit, particularly for subgroups. So low-income children in who are attending elementary schools in Indiana are getting a better education as a result. Now, let's be clear, we're in chaos across the country right now. I mean, I don't know, Chicago is among the worst, but in Indianapolis, in our Indianapolis public school system, 30 black children out of 1,000 can pass a basic state test. I mean, we're in chaos, and the system is not working for any child. And Chicago is even worse, right? I'm just watching what's going on up there and how many kids are lost for generations. And then you've got a group that's, I don't know if you saw this, there's something called the STOP Award. I don't know if you heard about this in Chicago.
No.
A really generous donor put up saying, well, we will fund any child in Chicago public schools who wants to go to a private school. It's called the STOP Award. They put $4.5 million out there to do that. Ironically, the Catholic schools said they didn't want to do that. I don't understand why that is, right? So there are opportunities available. This is an incredible award, but what I've heard is that this is, and people are taking it to go to other private schools. I was surprised to hear that the Archdiocese wasn't part of the process, you know? And who knows why, but the answer is we've got to give parents choices, right? And Chicago is the place we need to do it the most.
Sure, that's news to us. We'll have to check that out. Give us your perception of not just your perception, but how you think Chicago is perceived, because that's ground zero for school choice. It ought to be. If we really want to go into the belly of the beast, we need to try to sell it there. Talk about what the education establishment sees in Chicago. They recognize how bad it is, or are they dominated by, frankly, union thinking on this?
I think that the education reform movement, I don't want to speak for everyone, but I think there's a question that would be out there, like, Chicago, is it really savable, right? Is there some way to save what's going on? Because you look at it from an external perspective and say, it seems like sheer lunacy that they can't figure this out.
Robert, just to interrupt, you mean Chicago or Chicago Public Schools?
Chicago Public Schools.
Okay.
But look, also, think about it this way. It's not just Chicago Public Schools. If you live in Indianapolis, like I do, all you hear every weekend is how many numbers of people were killed in Chicago, right? This incredible, unfortunate narrative that's coming out, and the solutions don't need to seem to be there. Now, you have a scholarship program, which is great. It's $75 million. But it's really donor driven rather than parent driven, and that's fine and that's a good start. But you need a lot more.
Yeah, I'm happy we have the tax credit scholarship program. It was a trade that was won in exchange for all the budget mess we had back in 2017. But it's teeny, right? There's what I think 7,000 plus students in it, and good for them. But again, like you said, it's donor controlled. It's really not the empowerment that we want for parents to have individually, that they're in control. So right. Until we get to that, I think we're not excited and happy.
Yeah, you got to put money in the hands of parents.
Robert, do you have a particular form of school choice? We talked about what the variations are earlier, but a favorite?
My preferred type of choice is education savings accounts, right? Because what we want to do is to have all the money that is in the hands of a parent to customize their child's education. Look, we want universal vouchers. First of all, it has to be universal. Everyone's got to be able to choose, right? We are happy to give billionaires money to go to public schools. We should be happy to give them a small fraction of that to do whatever customization they want, right? We're giving money to billionaires to go to public schools or charter schools. I don't know if everyone thought about this, right? Anyone is free to go to a public or charter school. Right. And what we need to be able to do is put the money aside for families. And the way to do that best is education savings accounts. And here's why that's important. In 2010, it was the year of what we called school choice. School choice were vouchers. Indiana passed its voucher program in 2011 and Ohio passed a program. So it was all about schools. 2021 is the year of educational choice. Right. It's moving beyond this idea of school building and schools as a place to be and saying we want learning to happen in multiple places. Our polling shows that parents don't want to be in school 100% of the time for their kids. They want hybrid ideas. They want customization. They want to be able to do enrichment. And this is where education savings accounts can give them the power to do that.
You know, you mentioned rich kids, and, you know, so something that's always interested me is we always talk about the minority kids, and it's obvious why we talk about the minority kids. You know, their schools are typically the most underperforming. They're kind of stuck. They should have more choices. What I always try to remind people of is that, and you mentioned this, that the wealthy people, you know, by the virtue of being able to move to better school districts, can choose a better school. But it goes further than that, and this is why I always try to tell people, school choice is even bigger among wealthy people, because you have a lot of people who live in wealthy communities that pay really high property taxes, and yet their kids still go to private schools. So they're paying high property taxes for the public schools, and yet their kids, they have to spend again for private schools. So talk about school choice for you know, I think we forget to talk a little bit about, you know, how to make our best kids better as well. And I know that's kind of like anti the equity discussion we have, but I've always said we've got to do a great job of educating all our kids, and our best kids, our smartest kids, whatever you want to call them, our most competitive, should also have the best options.
Well, there's a lot in there to unpack, Ted, and I appreciate that. So couple things. One, I know all about those nutrier school costs, right? You know, if it's northern Chicago, and these things are, families will go up there and $33,000 of property tax later, and they don't want anyone there. I mean, look, this is where redlining becomes a socially oppressive issue, right? So the idea of school districts being allowed to exist the way they exist, right, actually exacerbates, as Milton would say, the stratification of society. We don't, this is where public schooling has become, he used to say, it's my favorite quote, the tragedy and the irony is that the system dedicated to creating a common set of values, a common set of citizenship, has in fact exacerbated the stratification of society. That's where we're at, and that's what happens when you have property tax. As it comes to gifted and talented, well, let me take one more step back. No one in this country can read. Let's be 40%, only 40% of all kids can read. Yes, there's a gap between black and white and brown and white. That's an important gap to understand. But 40% is the top, right? So if you look at the NAEP scores, 60% can't read on grade level. No one can read. Right. So those folks who are in public schools in the nicer areas, supposedly the wealthier areas, half their kids can't read either. Right. And they're just not understanding what that means. The other thing I would say about that is there are a lot of gifted and talented kids who happen to be kids of color, but the system isn't helping them and serving them. Right. In public schools in urban areas, they'll have international baccalaureate programs that they will set apart from the whole school, and it's full of white kids and all the black kids are down here because the school doesn't track them into these programs because it has such low expectations for them. You know, and you've got to ask yourself that they're like in New York City, they're closing down gifted and talented programs because they think it's racially disequitous. Well, maybe the system is the reason there's not kids of color in there, as opposed to the system being the reason, you know, for the problem. It's actually the system is really the problem, is that the system is not giving children of color the opportunity they need, and particularly children who are of color who are low income. So there's lots in that, but none of these kids can read if you look at the test scores.
Robert, give us your experience about communicating this issue. What resonates as you talk to people? If we want to reach voters, average voters, we're going to be spending a lot of time in this issue over the next year. What kind of message, language? You know, I've started calling them government schools just because that annoys the hell out of them instead of public schools. Maybe that's a little too blunt, but what have you found that works?
So that's a great question. Two things about that. One, I can win. I generally, with anyone of any side of the aisle, I've been very lucky. I was, when I did my postgraduate work, was liberation theology. So I was a radical lefty, and then I got to meet Milton Friedman. So I'm like the only person you probably met that actually studied liberation theology and then works for Milton Friedman, right, as a foundation. So there's incredible sort of background that I was lucky enough to have. So I can cross aisle talk, and I do, because I believe a lot of it. The problem is what takes me, and it should take me 2 to 5 minutes to go through, it takes the opponents 1 second because of the way the system works, which is, you know, it's basically nativist. Don't hurt your public school, which basically means don't hurt your home, which means keep the red line where it is, right? And so their message is you're harming public schools. And what they really are saying is if you let choice happen, your kid might not get the advantages. I mean, that's what's underlying this message. And the problem is we have to spend a lot of time talking about parent power, right? What does it mean to have parent power? The messages that do work, though, if you say families have the option and right to choose what's best for their kids, that works very well. And in particular, we don't care. We're agnostic. Here's the other thing, Mark. I don't care what a parent chooses. Right. I just don't. Right. If they want to choose a public school, I'm fine for that. If they want to choose a charter, private, online, at home, I don't care. What I want is families to have the power to choose. And that actually is the message that wins, the power to choose. Right. The power to control and choose. That's the winning message.
Free to choose. Friedman changed the world with his, I think, the television program, not the book, but the television program by that name. So
agreed.
But what was your experience then? Just going off of that real quick, what was your experience in working with him? And you mentioned you were on the far left and suddenly you changed. So give us a little bit of flavor for that. And I think the other question I had was, you know, what was your inspiration for entering into school choice anyway? Because you know, you're certainly passionate about it as you speak about it. So give us your background. Who is this man speaking to us and why is he so passionate?
I appreciate that question. I don't often get a chance to share this. I got lucky. I got born to a family that owned a newspaper and owned a bank. And I got the opportunity to attend a public school and then got sent to a boarding school, not through any merit of my own, not because I earned it, right? But because I just was able to afford it, right? And as I got to that school, I all of a sudden realized there was something immensely wrong with it when I was in eighth grade. There was something immensely wrong with the fact that I had access and it wasn't very equal, right? And so why was it that I had this access but not my neighbor or my best friend who was poor, who couldn't access this? And so there was always this sense of, in my mind, of why is it that the best schools can only be accessed with the most amount of money? This seems unjust in America. And particularly for unjust for families of color. And so that's been the reason I do what I do, is because I want to upend the nature of power that we have in our public school system, right? This idea that you can actually move to a suburban area or urban area or control the power through the money is not very American, particularly when it comes to education, in my opinion. Having your own money, great. Controlling other people's access to it because you have money, that's a problem, right? So that's my passion for why I choose this work, because I wanted to try and create a different set of power dynamics for families. When I came to Milton Friedman, I didn't even know who he was when I first got, to be honest with you. I mean, I was like, when I got the job, I got a job because it was a family friend, and my family knew him, Gordon Sinangelo, our first president. And then I found out it was Milton Friedman. I'm like, I had to do some research. And what I learned about Dr. Friedman and his wife, Rose, and by the way, they were equal partners. They are among the most generous of spirit, rigorous, best communicators I have ever met. Milton could communicate better than anyone I've ever seen in terms of tearing apart and discussing an idea. And he was very rigorous, and I was very lucky to get to know him in his last decade. And I'm blessed and honored to carry on the legacy of their organization, because our job is to basically achieve his vision where everyone gets a choice.
Well, tell us about your organization, EdChoice. For those of us that want to promote school choice, is it a resource for us? And how do we follow you? And give us some background on what your group does.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. So EdChoice is a national organization that promotes something very simple. We want all dollars to follow all kids to all schools, right? And it's learning opportunities. We do that by doing three specific things, right? We provide tons of research and information, both for policymakers and parents. If you want to know what's going on in Chicago or in Illinois with the school choice program, I can tell you how many schools are in it, what's going on with how much money is being spent. We're a great resource for that. And the second thing we do is training. So we run a ton of training programs for parent organizers, for policymakers, and for our partners on the ground. So there are groups like Empower Illinois that we actually helped. It was actually called EdChoice Illinois for a while. I don't know if you remember that, Ted. Mm-hmm. And it originally started as an EdChoice sort of partnership, which is great. So we do research and information training, and then we do what we call state investment, Mark, right? So we will go and work in a state that we think is ready for school choice, and we'll invest in it to try and educate the public on the benefits and need for school choice. So the most innovative program that's happened in the last 5 years happened last year in West Virginia, the tiny little state of West Virginia. It passed a nearly universal ESA program. In that state, every single child who's in a public school will now be able to access $4,600 on a card and go wherever they want.
It's amazing. That's phenomenal. So West Virginia, right?
West Virginia.
Yeah.
West Virginia can do this more than Illinois can do it. You would think, one of the things you may not know, our first president, Gordon Sinangelo, was a 10-term Indiana State Democrat Party chair. And actually was a national vice chair for the Democrat Party. And he used to say, after, he, of course, moved to Milton Friedman's side, he used to say, I don't understand why school choice isn't a Democrat issue. It should be a great society type issue where everyone has access to opportunity.
But, like you said, that's how we've sold it in my past. It's the best empowerment tool for a poor single mom, doesn't matter, what color, a grandmother who's taking care of a kid. It is just a great empowerment tool, and you would think that the Democrats would run with it, steal it, and go. But we don't see that happening, certainly not in Illinois.
No, and that's because they don't want to give up the power. The power of the money is so big.
Robert, to close out, could you give us some of the heroes of school choice? We talked about Milton Friedman. I know there's a lot of them out there. I had the chance to meet Howard Fuller and spend time with him in Milwaukee. And you get around those guys, and they're so inspirational. He was another guy who was you know, a black activist way back in the day who came around and just, just embraced the school choice. Can you give us a flavor of some people that some people might want to look up and kind of dig into their history?
Well, so I'm gonna approach this a little different way. And yes, but I will give that to you. First of all, I think the heroes of the school choice movement are every single family who every single day tries to do what's right for their kid. Right? Those are the heroes.
Ditto.
I think you guys are heroes every single day talking about this stuff because this is so important. But if you're asking for people who are well known, Virginia Walden Ford, who's on our board, she was the DC Parents for School Choice. She was the one that basically helped get the DC scholarship program enacted. And she's the heroine of the movie Miss Virginia. She's one of my inspirations of all time. Obviously, Howard is there, Milton is there, but Clint Bolick. I don't know if you remember Clint Bolick, who was at the Institute for Justice, was one of the lawyers that made sure that Wisconsin's program and the Supreme Court program ended up being legal, right? So Clint's a big hero. Susan Mitchell from where you are, Mark, in Wisconsin, right? She was one of the leading lights early on of school choice. You so many people, John Kirtley in Florida, Matt Ladner, people have been fighting this stuff for years, but the real heroes, to be honest, are the ones that are every day, these parents who are fighting for it.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear. You're reminding me of one thing that I can't leave undone before you leave us, which is the big argument always used in many states, certainly in Illinois, is the separation of funding, state funding for schools and the church. So again, private schools. Give us an update on where that stands federally.
Yeah, so the argument is that you can't have school choice is unconstitutional because you should not fund religion, right? We have the separation of school, of church and state, right? The legal argument about school choice has always been it's never aid to schools, it's aid to families, right? In the same way that Medicare and Medicaid is aid to a person to choose this hospital or service they want, school choice is aid to families to choose whatever educational environment is neutrally applied. This has been the precedent that has gone forward in the U.S. Supreme Court through the tax credit programs and then through Zelman v. Harris decision, which was the Cleveland school voucher decision. Now what we're seeing are direct Trinity versus Lutheran, which was basically saying you actually can give money directly to schools because as long as you give them to all schools. And the biggest case right now is the Carson v. Macon case, which will hopefully end this idea of Blaine amendments. You guys have probably talked about this before. Blaine amendments were these amendments put together by James G. Blaine in the mid-1800s, who basically hated Catholics and didn't think Catholics should get any money, particularly schools. And so he went around saying no public money for sectarian institutions. So while they read the Bible in public schools all the way up through the 50s, it was just the Protestant Bible, not the Catholic Bible. These Blaine amendments have been a serious impediment to school choice. And Carson v. Macon, which is the case right now in front of the court, will hopefully help end that. And so the idea is we live in a pluralist society, and as long as you don't favor or advance one religion over another, our Constitution says you can give money to anyone, should say you can give money to anyone. And that's the precedent that's happening nationally.
Well, just to wrap up from my perspective, I find it fascinating, telling, and not at all surprising that as a young man you were drawn to liberation theology, which is, of course, a very liberal thing, but the central premise of which is equality and true social justice. But you've gravitated, as I would hope anybody that's interested in those things is, to focus on school choice, because it really is the civil rights issue of our time. If you don't have equality of opportunity and education, then you don't have a good education. Education is the great equalizer. School choice is the building block for it.
You got it right. And I think the only difference between now, then and now is, like, for me, liberation theology was they have a huge distrust in the monopoly in government, right? There's a huge distrust of people who are liberation theologians. But the solution is well, we're just better at it. We have a better widget, right? The solution on Milton Friedman's side was they understood the same problem. The government is a bad monopoly. The solution on Milton's side, which I've come to believe in, is that individuals working in their own self-interest can actually do this job better than someone else. than rather than coercion and mandating. And so you're absolutely right. This is, I don't think this is just the civil rights issue of our time. I think this is the human rights issues of our time, right? This is about everyone getting the access and opportunity that they deserve, because if they don't have a good education or at least a good learning, whether that's by education, what do we mean by that? Are they, if they get a good competent trade skill or they get a good competent certificate program, as long as they have the ability to control their destiny and their self-actualize, then they're going to get a society. Rose used to say it this way, Rose Friedman, if you can't read, you can't write, you can't compute, you don't know history, who's going to govern the affairs of our country? And the reality is you need these educational option programs, because we need to improve the quality of learning in our country so that we can actually have a country, right, going forward. Because if you don't have people who are smart enough to understand how democracy works, you end up where we are now.
Amen. Robert, thank you for joining us. That was a great ending and so true. So thank you for being with us. And we look forward to talking to you in the future, and all the best.
Thank you so much, Robert. Take care.
Thanks for having me, guys.